All right, we welcome everybody to the Second Court of Appeals. To my right is Justice Sue Walker. To my left is Justice Bill Meyer. And I'm Chief Justice Terry Livingston. We have two cases on our 9 a.m. docket, so we will go through both of those one after another. Then we'll take a short recess and set up for the 10:30 cases. The first case we will hear is McCoy versus McCoy, cause number 215-208-CV. And I understand both counsel have checked in and are ready to present their arguments, asking for their full amount of time. So first we have Mr. McCoy.
Is the court?
Okay, a brief background on this case. In August 2010, I began law school at Texas Tech University. And then 5 months later, on March 19th of 2011, I married the appellee, Ms. McCoy. And then August of that same year of 2011, she started law school also 1 year behind me at Texas Tech. Over the course of the marriage, each of us depended entirely on student loan proceeds for our living and tuition. And as we received those student loan proceeds, we kept them in separate bank accounts and never commingled the money that came from those or credit cards or anything like this. And we had an arrangement that I would pay all of our living expenses and any sort of cost of living that was associated with travel, you name it, during this time, and she would reimburse me at the end of each month. Well, the problem was that she was using her student loan proceeds to pay down her own credit card debt, and as well as student loans that she incurred prior to our getting married. And at the end of each semester, or middle to end of each semester, she would no longer be able to reimburse me the amounts that we had agreed to, and I was kind of stuck footing the bill for both of us. And as a result of which, I had to acquire supplemental student loans and be able to cover both of our expenses. And all in all, I paid $37,683 of her expenses, and she reimbursed me for $11,000 of that, leaving $26,683 unreimbursed. And then in May of 2013, as I approached graduation, at this point in time, I didn't have a job, and so I was concerned about how I was going to be able to continue to pay her living expenses during her last year of school. And I expressed to her that she would probably need to request more student loans for herself. And 3 weeks after this conversation, she filed for divorce against what seemed to be an otherwise fine marriage. As she had 2 months prior to the discussion, she had sent me a text message where she said, and I quote, that I am such a wonderful husband. And let's see. Then at trial, I sought for the reimbursement of the $26,683 and presented the court with Respondent's Exhibit 3, which is a summary of the expenses taken from my bank statements and credit card statements. That exhibit and this evidence was not disputed. She never disputed that.
Isn't it true that your reimbursement request was for living expenses, for her portion of living expenses?
Among other things, it was not just living expenses that it was for. It included things like travel and entertainment and going out to movies, things like this. And so, let's see, where was I? So, this evidence was undisputed, but despite that, my claim was denied on the basis that this key piece of evidence, the summary of my expenses, was too difficult for the judge to dissect. And then at trial, the appellee also made a request for legal fees, appellant legal fees, which was denied, but then in a post-trial motion for temporary orders pending appeal, this motion was granted, awarding her legal fees despite no hearing of any evidence of any kind. And then, so the two issues here are the arbitrary and unreasonable denial of my reimbursement claim and the award of appellee's attorney's fees with zero evidence to support her claim. And as far as my reimbursement claim goes, there's four hurdles here that that my claim has to overcome. The first is whether my student loan proceeds were indeed separate property. The second is whether Texas courts still recognize a common law reimbursement claim, whether I do in fact have a common law reimbursement claim, and whether this claim is barred by the Family Code's list of non-reimbursable claims. And so a common law reimbursement claim has three elements for me to succeed here. One is that I have to prove that student loan proceeds were my separate property, that they benefited the appellee, and that I received no benefit from without myself receiving some benefit. And as far as the arguments that this was my separate property, I asserted in the pleadings that I sought reimbursement for using my student loans proceeds, which were my separate property. Both appellee and I introduced a myriad of testimony showing that we intended those proceeds to be separate property.
Mr. McCoy?
Yes, sir.
All these loans were made subsequent to your marriage, weren't they?
That's correct.
What makes them separate property?
Well, it's that the way that we treated them and intended them to be, for one thing.
I think that your intentions override the law that debts incurred during the marriage or community debts?
Well, in the case of student loan proceeds, that's correct.
I said in the statute somewhere it says student loan proceeds are exempted?
Well, no, but if we are to we're to look at if we were to call these community debts, then we have a whole other argument that we need to add on here of whether or not it was fair or equitable to.
Might have had to add that on in the trial court.
Well, I mean, I don't have the case in front of me, but there is some case law that suggests that student loan proceeds in particular are indeed separate property.
Okay, thank you.
And so, assuming that I've met these three elements for the common law reimbursement claim, the question then becomes whether Section 3402 of the Family Code, which provides nine reimbursable claims, is an exhaustive or non-exhaustive list. And the easiest argument for it being a non-exhaustive list is that the plain language of the statute includes a claim for reimbursement includes. And the term includes, according to the Texas Government Code, is a term of enlargement and not a term of exclusion. So that would mean that there is availability of common law reimbursement claims that are still recognized by the court. And one of these, in fact, is recognized in a case called Frosto v. Frosto, 611 Southwest 2nd at 660. And there, a wife used her nursing income to support her husband through med school. And right after he graduated, he divorced her. And the court was answering the question as to whether she was entitled to reimbursement for the support she gave her husband. And the court held that she wasn't, but only because that her nursing income was community property. And the court acknowledged that had her nursing income been separate property, she would have had a claim. And so my argument here is that these student loan proceeds are separate property. It's been argued before, but I don't think any court's ever reached a specific decision as to whether that's the case. And then perhaps the biggest hurdle that I have to overcome is whether there's a statutory bar on the reimbursement of spousal living expenses as a hard and fast rule. And so in this case, you know, as I said before, undisputed facts show that, I borrowed money that I spent on her and her living expenses, her travel, entertainment, and everything else. And I continue to have to be burdened with this debt while she, you know, she's not. Her student loan expenses are far lower than mine. And
well, doesn't Section 3.409 of the Family Code specifically say that the court may not recognize a marital estate's claim for reimbursement for the living expenses of a spouse?
Yes, it does. And so in order for me to overcome the effect of that statute, my argument is that it conflicts with Section 707, which requires equitable principles be applied to all reimbursement.
Doesn't a specific statute control over a general statute?
It does, with one exception, and the exception is the general provision is the latter enactment, and the manifest intent is that the general provision prevail. And here, the general provision was passed in 2009, and the specific provision was 2001, I believe. So it was definitely the later enacted statute. And then as far as whether it's the manifest intent that the general provision prevail, the throughout the family code, it's the legislature is fairly clear that that equity and fairness is the underlying principle of the day. And as I said before, if we were to apply 3409 here, it will eviscerate the fairness and equity that's required of Section 7001 as well as 7007. And the second reason why I would argue that Section 3409 does not apply here is that this court held that courts should not enforce the plain meaning of the statute's text if doing so leads to absurd or nonsensical results. And in determining the meaning of a statute, a court must consider the entire act, its nature and object, and the consequences that would follow from each construction. And so if we look at what was going on here, I was borrowing money and using it to pay her expenses so she could use money that she was borrowing to pay her credit card debts, right? So fundamentally, this is no different from if I had actually been paying her credit cards myself, right? And so, which would yield a reimbursable income under Section 3402 of the Family Code. And that concludes my arguments as far as my reimbursement claim. As for the appellate legal fees go, the law is that she had to prove, first of all, that I was able to that she needed them, that she required those fees to be paid because she couldn't pay them herself, and second, that I had the ability to pay them. And there was, like I said before, there was no evidence of any kind, including this, that was presented at the hearing to prove these facts and for her to meet her burden of proof.
The record on appeal does not include the transcript of the hearing that was set specially to consider the motion for appellate attorney's fees.
Yes, there was one requested, but there was no record taken of that proceeding.
Thank you.
And that's my conclusion if there's no more questions.
All right, thank you, Mr. McCoy. Mr. Waddell.
Please, the court counsel. Well, you can see that my brief is short and to the point, all right? And during my tenure at the Texas Wesleyan School of Law as a professor and now A&M School of Law, I taught marital property rights and wrote a textbook on it, but in one section, of course, my book is in reimbursement, Your Honors. But one thing that I pointed out to the students during those classes is that you can't get reimbursement for the hamburgers. And this is what we're thinking here. We want reimbursement for living expenses, Judge. And again, first off, let me say this. We don't agree that the student loans were separate property because Gleets versus Bongio from the Supreme Court from the 1930s has made it completely clear that the only way for a separate property, a debt taken during the marriage, the proceeds of that debt to be separate property is if the lender agrees specifically in writing to look solely for the separate property. All right, and that, I mean, that's been the law of Texas for nearly more than 70 years now. So to hold that student loans have some certain nature, they're certainly nothing in the federal statutes about student loans that they will be considered separate property of the borrower within states that have community property aspects, the 11 states around the country that have that. So basically, if in fact the student loans are not at law separate property, then this case is over because he's seeking reimbursement for the expenditure of his separate property. So I say in my brief, and I think that the Supreme Court case many cases have cited Leach versus Bonkio. That was the seminal case that decided this issue of what was community as far as the proceeds of a loan taken during the marriage. So if it's, so just for purposes of appeal argument here, if in fact this court were to hold that somehow student loans are separate property, which I do not think the court will, then we then have to turn to the issue of what is anything here reimbursable. Again, the appellant argues that, well, the general statute was passed sometime after this specific statute, but if in fact the legislature intended to overrule the specific statute, they just would have overruled it. They wouldn't have passed a statute that says, well, in certain cases, you don't have to pay attention to the general, to the specific statute. So basically, I will point out too, the record doesn't reflect exactly what the funds were expended on, other than he took it out of his bank account and wrote checks. It also, the record doesn't reflect what expenses that the wife, in this case, our client, expended out of her separate property loans, because he's claiming that they somehow intended for their loans to be separate property. And like you say, Judge, the intent of the parties has nothing to do with the characterization of an asset as community or separate. The Constitution determines it under the definition of separate property, because basically community property is not defined. It's just everything else but separate property. So since Arnold versus Leonard in the first part of the century, the Supreme Court has held that the Constitution of Texas determines the nature of separate and community property, and then Leach versus Bonkio in the 1930s recognized that determination. So now we have a situation where we're arguing for the hamburgers. Well, you know, travel is not living expenses, Your Honor. You know, movies isn't living expenses. Of course they are. And so we have a situation here of trying to decide which estate is supposed to reimburse which estate. And again, he's claiming his separate estate should be reimbursed. There's no separate estate. There was no community property income by his own admission in his brief. They didn't work during the marriage, so there was no community property income. And this court has a case from the 1980s, but before the reimbursement statute was passed, that basically talks about this type of situation, although I don't think it's that applicable anymore because there's a new statute. But it basically says if there's no community property to expend, then you can't get reimbursement from the separate estates because you had no place else to spend the money from but that, assuming that there was a separate estate. And that case is, it is Oliver versus Oliver from the Fort Worth Court of Appeals, 741 Southwest 2nd, 225. So again, I'm not so excited about Oliver because it was passed before the statute that you mentioned, Your Honor, was passed. Again, I think it was obvious that the legislature intended to clear up this, and they've been litigating reimbursement in the 1990s and the early 2000s. They've just decided to clear up this issue of what's reimbursable and what's not. So my point is there was no separate estate proved up at the trial court. There was no proof of any case at all in the trial record that there's a separate estate of these parties, period. The money they borrowed during their time at law school was community property, period. Then there's no proof, and as the finding of facts and conclusions of the law state, the judge found there was no proof by preponderance of an evidence that there was any reimbursable expense there. So our finding of facts and conclusions of law support the trial court's decision. On the second issue, as you said, Judge, that was a hearing that's allowed by the Family Code post-appeal for the court to award attorney's fees, and neither attorney at that hearing asked for the trial record to be made, and there was no trial record made. The judge just listened to the, I'm assuming, because he entered an order. Mr. Hoover was there. I wasn't. So there's nothing for the court to speak to that issue because there's no record. Previously, there was an appeal here by the appellant to overturn that hearing, and you sent that back as basically no record. So you've already, I think it's res judicata on that issue. That's why I didn't make a second appeal brief here to answer his amended appeal brief. I mean, I believe you decided that whatever the judge said at the trial court about attorneys on fees on appeal is set in stone now. You know, I don't want to beat a dead horse anymore, but I can't think of any way. Well, one other thing. If we consider what the effect within the Second Court of Appeals District would be for you to rule for the appellant. You will essentially have overruled the specific statute concerning reimbursement, and you've opened up an area. Not only do I think just student loans, but any claim that if I spent my debt on living expenses, now it's reimbursable because this case is, would be found in favor of the appellant. So the effect on the future cases in this area would be somewhat affected by this decision, whereas, and again, how in the world does it make sense for this court to overrule the legislature on that specific statute? And that's all I have, Your Honors.
I had one question, Mr. Waddell, on the appellate attorney fees that were added post-trial.
Yes, ma'am.
Usually we see appellate attorney fees ordered conditionally on a successful appeal. Does that impact your judgment for appellate attorney fees?
I think it does, Judge, because that section of the statute that we got the attorney's fees for is not asking, it's not designed to reimburse for the actual cost of the appeal. I think it's designed to reimburse for the expenses during the preparation of the appeal, because it's, you know, it's that special statute that says within 2 weeks of the appeal you can come back and ask for attorney's fees. And I think that statute is designed to give relief to the cost of the appeal, not the attorney's fees for the trial. This is not, in my opinion, an award of attorney's fees for the trial. And so I believe that the judge can take a look at the nature of the appeal, and if you look at the motion for new trial that's in here, you see that basically the claim was made for this in the motion for new trial and this for the reimbursement again. There was an idea that he might have appealed the granting of the divorce on the grounds of fraud, but he didn't. But it's clear from the judge when he was, I think, at the hearing on attorney's fees that this issue of reimbursement was going to be presented to the court, and I think that award is to compensate her for the cost of what I appeal is a frivolous appeal. I mean, the attorney, the appellant is pro se, but he's a licensed attorney in Texas. And I will say that there is confusion, Judge, about debts taken during the marriage. There's lots of lawyers that think that debts during the marriage somehow are not community or could be a separate property. I will then charge him with just the fact that he's not that experienced yet, Your Honor. But you can't overlook Leach versus Bongill. You just can't.
Mr. Waddell, don't you think it's commendable for a beginning law student to get right into the Court of Appeals? I mean, a beginning lawyer?
You know, I've always been concerned when I started here 30 years ago. We always got an oral argument, right? But now we don't get it accepted when you grant it to us. That may be for efficiency, I don't know. But I think that the oral argument can serve to settle things. You know, in other words, we know what you're doing because you ask us the questions.
I want you to be understanding that we pretty well grant oral arguments on any case where the lawyers ask for it and insist on wanting to do that. It's not that I agree with you. Years ago, we had more oral arguments, but it's not because the court isn't interested in hearing from the lawyers.
I don't think that's the case, Judge. I just think that now, you know, unless if you have the attorneys that are steeped in this, most of us realize that the briefs are probably going to decide it, all right? Oral argument sometimes can lead to a question that determines it. We didn't ask for oral argument here because we thought that it was so blatantly cut and dry that we didn't need it.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you, Judge.
Questions.
Yes, sir.
All right, Mr. McCoy. Thank you, Mr. Waddell.
All right. In the case that Mr. Waddell cited about debts taken during the marriage being community debts, a key part of his that rule is that that is unless the lender looks solely to the borrower for repayment, which is the case with student loans. My student loan lender is not going to look to my ex-wife for repayment of these student loans. And they would only look to perhaps a cosigner, which there were not on either of ours, as to whether those one, her or I, was responsible. And then he said that the record does not reflect what these my expenditures were for, but that's just simply not true. I went to a great deal of effort to list rent, water bills, electricity, food. All these things are broken down very clearly by category in terms of what they're for, as well as the dates that the expenditures occurred. And this is all supported by credit card statements that I have that, you know, that show that that's what these things were for. And furthermore, she never disputed in trial that this is what these things were for. And then as far as spousal living expenses go, there's an exception that allows for reimbursement of spousal living expenses when the benefits and burdens arising from these from the expenditures are not transitory, and which is the case here. Her benefit gets to carry forward out of the marriage by not having to repay these debts that would have incurred but for me bearing that burden myself. And similarly, I carry the burden going forward insofar as that I continue to have to pay these debts that were incurred on her behalf and for her benefit. That's my conclusion.
All right. Thank you, Mr. McCoy, Mr. Waddell, and Mr. Hoover. We do appreciate your submissions of your briefing today and your oral arguments. Your case is now submitted, so you all are excused.